This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Divergent by Veronica Roth, performed by Emma Galvin. Chapter 1. There is one mirror in my house. It is behind a sliding panel in the hallway upstairs. Our faction allows me to stand in front of it on the second day of every third month, the day my mother cuts my hair. I sit on the stool and my mother stands behind me with the scissors, trimming. The strands fall on the floor in a dull, blonde ring. When she finishes, she pulls my hair away from my face and twists it into a knot. I note how calm she looks and how focused she is. She is well practiced in the art of losing herself. I can't say the same of myself. I sneak a look at my reflection when she isn't paying attention, not for the sake of vanity, but out of curiosity. A lot can happen to a person's appearance in 3 months. In my reflection, I see a narrow face, wide round eyes, and a long thin nose. I still look like a little girl, though sometime in the last few months I turned 16. The other factions celebrate birthdays, but we don't. It would be self-indulgent. "There," she says when she pins the knot in place. Her eyes catch mine in the mirror. It is too late to look away. But instead of scolding me, she smiles at our reflection. I frown a little. Why doesn't she reprimand me for staring at myself? "So today is the day," she says. "Yes," I reply. "Are you nervous?" I stare into my own eyes for a moment. Today is the day of the aptitude test that will show me which of the 5 factions I belong in. And tomorrow, at the choosing ceremony, I will decide on a faction. I will decide the rest of my life. I will decide to stay with my family or abandon them. "No," I say. "The tests don't have to change our choices." "Right," she smiles. "Let's go eat breakfast. Thank you for cutting my hair." She kisses my cheek and slides the panel over the mirror. I think my mother could be beautiful, in a different world. Her body is thin beneath the gray robe. She has high cheekbones and long eyelashes, and when she lets her hair down at night, it hangs in waves over her shoulders. But she must hide that beauty in abnegation. We walk together to the kitchen. On these mornings when my brother makes breakfast, and my father's hand skims my hair as he reads the newspaper, and my mother hums as she clears the table, it is on these mornings that I feel guiltiest for wanting to leave them. The bus stinks of exhaust. Every time it hits a patch of uneven pavement, it jostles me from side to side, even though I'm gripping the seat to keep myself still. My older brother, Caleb, stands in the aisle, holding a railing above his head to keep himself steady. We don't look alike. He has my father's dark hair and hooked nose, and my mother's green eyes and dimpled cheeks. When he was younger, that collection of features looked strange, but now it suits him. If he was an abnegation, I'm sure the girls at school would stare at him. He also inherited my mother's talent for selflessness. He gave his seat to a surly candor man on the bus without a second thought. The candor man wears a black suit with a white tie, candor standard uniform. Their faction values honesty and sees the truth as black and white, so that is what they wear. The gaps between the buildings narrow, and the roads are smoother as we near the heart of the city. The building that was once called the Sears Tower, we call it the Hub, emerges from the fog, a black pillar in the skyline. The bus passes under the elevated tracks. I have never been on a train, though they never stop running, and there are tracks everywhere. Only the dauntless ride them. 5 years ago, volunteer construction workers from abnegation repaved some of the roads. They started in the middle of the city and worked their way outward until they ran out of materials. The roads where I live are still cracked and patchy, and it's not safe to drive on them. We don't have a car anyway. Caleb's expression is placid as the bus sways and jolts on the road. The gray robe falls from his arm as he clutches a pole for balance. I can tell by the constant shift of his eyes that he is watching the people around us, striving to see only them and to forget himself. Candor values honesty, but our faction, abnegation, values selflessness. The bus stops in front of the school and I get up, scooting past the candor man. I grab Caleb's arm as I stumble over the man's shoes. My slacks are too long, and I've never been that graceful. The upper levels building is the oldest of the three schools in the city. Lower levels, mid levels, and upper levels. Like all the other buildings around it, it is made of glass and steel. In front of it is a large metal sculpture that the dauntless climb after school, daring each other to go higher and higher. Last year I watched one of them fall and break her leg. I was the one who ran to get the nurse. "Aptitude tests today," I say. Caleb is not quite a year older than I am, so we are in the same year at school. He nods as we pass through the front doors. My muscles tighten the second we walk in. The atmosphere feels hungry, like every 16-year-old is trying to devour as much as he can get of this last day. It is likely that we will not walk these halls again after the choosing ceremony. Once we choose, our new factions will be responsible for finishing our education. Our classes are cut in half today, so we will attend all of them before the aptitude tests, which take place after lunch. My heart rate is already elevated. "You aren't at all worried about what they'll tell you?" I ask Caleb. We pause at the split in the hallway where he will go one way, toward advanced math, and I will go the other, toward faction history. He raises an eyebrow at me. "Are you?" I could tell him I've been worried for weeks about what the aptitude test will tell me. Abnegation, candor, erudite, amity, or dauntless. Instead, I smile and say, "Not really." He smiles back. "Well, have a good day." I walk toward faction history, chewing on my lower lip. He never answered my question. The hallways are cramped. Though the light coming through the windows creates the illusion of space, they are one of the only places where the factions mix at our age. Today the crowd has a new kind of energy, a last-day mania. A girl with long curly hair shouts, "Hey!" next to my ear, waving at a distant friend. A jacket sleeve smacks me on the cheek. Then an erudite boy in a blue sweater shoves me. I lose my balance and fall hard on the ground. "Out of my way, stiff!" he snaps, and continues down the hallway. My cheeks warm. I get up and dust myself off. A few people stopped when I fell, but none of them offered to help me. Their eyes follow me to the edge of the hallway. This sort of thing has been happening to others in my faction for months now. The erudite have been releasing antagonistic reports about abnegation, and it has begun to affect the way we relate at school. The gray clothes, the plain hairstyle, and the unassuming demeanor of my faction are supposed to make it easier for me to forget myself, and easier for everyone else to forget me, too. But now they make me a target. I pause by a window in the E-wing and wait for the dauntless to arrive. I do this every morning. At exactly 7:25, the dauntless prove their bravery by jumping from a moving train. My father calls the dauntless hellions. They are pierced, tattooed, and black-clothed. Their primary purpose is to guard the fence that surrounds our city. From what? I don't know. They should perplex me. I should wonder what courage, which is the virtue they most value, has to do with a metal ring through your nostril. Instead, my eyes cling to them, wherever they go. The train whistle blares, the sound resonating in my chest. The light fixed to the front of the train clicks on and off as the train hurtles past the school, squealing on iron rails. And as the last few cars pass, A mass exodus of young men and women in dark clothing hurl themselves from the moving cars, some dropping and rolling, others stumbling a few steps before regaining their balance. One of the boys wraps his arm around a girl's shoulders, laughing. Watching them is a foolish practice. I turn away from the window and press through the crowd to the faction history classroom. Chapter 2. The tests begin after lunch. We sit at the long tables in the cafeteria, and the test administrators call 10 names at a time, one for each testing room. I sit next to Caleb, and across from our neighbor Susan. Susan's father travels throughout the city for his job, so he has a car, and drives her to and from school every day. He offered to drive us too, but as Caleb says, we prefer to leave later and would not want to inconvenience him. Of course not. The test administrators are mostly abnegation volunteers, although there is an erudite in one of the testing rooms and a dauntless in another to test those of us from abnegation, because the rules state that we can't be tested by someone from our own faction. The rules also say that we can't prepare for the test in any way, so I don't know what to expect. My gaze drifts from Susan to the dauntless tables across the room. They are laughing and shouting and playing cards. At another set of tables, the erudite chatter over books and newspapers in constant pursuit of knowledge. A group of amity girls in yellow and red sit in a circle on the cafeteria floor, playing some kind of hand-slapping game involving a rhyming song. Every few minutes I hear a chorus of laughter from them as someone is eliminated and has to sit in the center of the circle. At the table next to them, candor boys make wide gestures with their hands. They appear to be arguing about something, but it must not be serious, because some of them are still smiling. At the abnegation table, we sit quietly and wait. Faction customs dictate even idle behavior and supersede individual preference. I doubt all the erudite want to study all the time, or that every candor enjoys a lively debate, but they can't defy the norms of their factions any more than I can. Caleb's name is called in the next group. He moves confidently toward the exit. I don't need to wish him luck, or assure him that he shouldn't be nervous. He knows where he belongs, and as far as I know, he always has. My earliest memory of him is from when we were 4 years old. He scolded me for not giving my jump rope to a little girl on the playground who didn't have anything to play with. He doesn't lecture me often anymore, but I have his look of disapproval memorized. I have tried to explain to him that my instincts are not the same as his. It didn't even enter my mind to give my seat to the candor man on the bus. But he doesn't understand. "Just do what you're supposed to," he always says. It is that easy for him. It should be that easy for me. My stomach wrenches. I close my eyes and keep them closed until 10 minutes later, when Caleb sits down again. He is plaster pale. He pushes his palms along his legs like I do when I wipe off sweat, and when he brings them back, his fingers shake. I open my mouth to ask him something, but the words don't come. I am not allowed to ask him about his results, and he is not allowed to tell me. An abnegation volunteer speaks the next round of names. 2 from Dauntless, 2 from Erudite, 2 from Amity, 2 from Candor, and then, from Abnegation, Susan Black and Beatrice Pryor. I get up because I'm supposed to, but if it were up to me, I would stay in my seat for the rest of time. I feel like there is a bubble in my chest that expands more by the second, threatening to break me apart from the inside. I follow Susan to the exit. The people I pass probably can't tell us apart. We wear the same clothes, and we wear our blonde hair the same way. The only difference is that Susan might not feel like she's going to throw up. And from what I can tell, her hands aren't shaking so hard she has to clutch the hem of her shirt to steady them. Waiting for us outside the cafeteria is a row of 10 rooms. They are used only for the aptitude tests, so I have never been in one before. Unlike the other rooms in the school, they are separated, not by glass, but by mirrors. I watch myself, pale and terrified, walking toward one of the doors. Susan grins nervously at me as she walks into room 5, and I walk into room 6, where a dauntless woman waits for me. She is not as severe-looking as the young dauntless I have seen. She has small, dark, angular eyes, and wears a black blazer, like a man's suit, and jeans. It is only when she turns to close the door that I see a tattoo on the back of her neck. A black and white hawk with a red eye. If I didn't feel like my heart had migrated to my throat, I would ask her what it signifies. It must signify something. Mirrors cover the inner walls of the room. I can see my reflection from all angles. The gray fabric obscuring the shape of my back, my long neck, my knobby knuckled hands, red with a blood blush. The ceiling glows white with light. In the center of the room is a reclined chair, like a dentist's, with a machine next to it. It looks like a place where terrible things happen. "Don't worry," the woman says. "It doesn't hurt." Her hair is black and straight, but in the light, I see that it is streaked with gray. "Have a seat and get comfortable," she says. "My name is Tori." Clumsily, I sit in the chair and recline, putting my head on the headrest. The lights hurt my eyes. Tori busies herself with the machine on my right. I try to focus on her, and not on the wires in her hands. "Why the hawk?" I blurt out as she attaches an electrode to my forehead. "Never met a curious abnegation before," she says, raising her eyebrows at me. I shiver, and goosebumps appear on my arms. My curiosity is a mistake, a betrayal of abnegation values. Humming a little, she presses another electrode to my forehead and explains, "In some parts of the ancient world, the hawk symbolized the sun. Back when I got this, I figured if I always had the sun on me, I wouldn't be afraid of the dark." I try to stop myself from asking another question, but I can't help it. "You're afraid of the dark?" "I was afraid of the dark," she corrects me. She presses the next electrode to her own forehead and attaches a wire to it. She shrugs. "Now it reminds me of the fear I've overcome." She stands behind me. I squeeze the armrests so tightly the redness pulls away from my knuckles. She tugs wires toward her, attaching them to me, to her, to the machine behind her. Then she passes me a vial of clear liquid. "Drink this," she says. "What is it?" My throat feels swollen. I swallow hard. "What's going to happen?" "Can't tell you that. Just trust me." I press air from my lungs and tip the contents of the vial into my mouth. My eyes close. When they open, an instant has passed, but I'm somewhere else. I stand in the school cafeteria again, but all the long tables are empty. And I see through the glass walls that it's snowing. On the table in front of me are 2 baskets. In one is a hunk of cheese, and in the other, a knife the length of my forearm. Behind me, a woman's voice says, "Choose." "Why?" I ask. "Choose," she repeats. I look over my shoulder, but no one is there. I turn back to the baskets. "What will I do with them?" "Choose!" she yells. When she screams at me, my fear disappears, and stubbornness replaces it. I scowl and cross my arms. "Have it your way," she says. The baskets disappear. I hear a door squeak, and turn to see who it is. I see not a who, but a what. A dog, with a pointed nose, stands a few yards away from me. It crouches low and creeps toward me, its lips peeling back from its white teeth. A growl gurgles from deep in its throat, and I see why the cheese would have come in handy, or the knife. But it's too late now. I think about running, but the dog will be faster than me. I can't wrestle it to the ground. My head pounds. I have to make a decision. If I can jump over one of the tables and use it as a shield, no, I'm too short to jump over the tables and not strong enough to tip one over. The dog snarls, and I can almost feel the sound vibrating in my skull. My biology textbook said that dogs can smell fear because of a chemical secreted by human glands in a state of duress. The same chemical a dog's prey secretes. Smelling fear leads them to attack. The dog inches toward me, its nails scraping the floor. I can't run. I can't fight. Instead, I breathe in the smell of the dog's foul breath and try not to think about what it just ate. There are no whites in its eyes, just a black gleam. What else do I know about dogs? I shouldn't look it in the eye. That's a sign of aggression. I remember asking my father for a pet dog when I was young, and now, staring at the ground in front of the dog's paws, I can't remember why. It comes closer, still growling. If staring into its eyes is a sign of aggression, what's a sign of submission? My breaths are loud but steady. I sink to my knees. The last thing I want to do is lie down on the ground in front of the dog, making its teeth level with my face. But it's the best option I have. I stretch my legs out behind me and lean on my elbows. The dog creeps closer and closer until I feel its warm breath on my face. My arms are shaking. It barks in my ear, and I clench my teeth to keep from screaming. Something rough and wet touches my cheek. The dog's growling stops, and when I lift my head to look at it again, it is panting. It licked my face. I frown and sit on my heels. The dog props its paws up on my knees and licks my chin. I cringe, wiping the drool from my skin, and laugh. You're not such a vicious beast, huh? I get up slowly so I don't startle it, but it seems like a different animal than the one that faced me a few seconds ago. I stretch out a hand, carefully, so I can draw it back if I need to. The dog nudges my hand with its head. I am suddenly glad I didn't pick up the knife. I blink, and when my eyes open, a child stands across the room wearing a white dress. She stretches out both hands and squeals, "Puppy!" As she runs toward the dog at my side, I open my mouth to warn her, but I am too late. The dog turns. Instead of growling, it barks and snarls and snaps, and its muscles bunch up like coiled wire, about to pounce. I don't think. I just jump. I hurl my body on top of the dog, wrapping my arms around its thick neck. My head hits the ground. The dog is gone, and so is the little girl. Instead, I am alone. In the testing room, now empty. I turn in a slow circle and can't see myself in any of the mirrors. I push the door open and walk into the hallway, but it isn't a hallway. It's a bus, and all the seats are taken. I stand in the aisle and hold on to a pole. Sitting near me is a man with a newspaper. I can't see his face over the top of the paper, but I can see his hands. They are scarred, like he was burned, and they clench around the paper like he wants to crumple it. "Do you know this guy?" he asks. He taps the picture on the front page of the newspaper. The headline reads, "Brutal murderer finally apprehended." I stare at the word murderer. It has been a long time since I last read that word, but even its shape fills me with dread. In the picture beneath the headline is a young man with a plain face and a beard. I feel like I do know him, though I don't remember how, and at the same time, I feel like it would be a bad idea to tell the man that. "Well?" I hear anger in his voice. "Do you?" "A bad idea. No, a very bad idea." My heart pounds, and I clutch the pole to keep my hands from shaking, from giving me away. If I tell him I know the man from the article, Something awful will happen to me. But I can convince him that I don't. I can clear my throat and shrug my shoulders. But that would be a lie. I clear my throat. "Do you?" he repeats. I shrug my shoulders. "Well?" A shudder goes through me. My fear is irrational. This is just a test. It isn't real. "Nope," I say, my voice casual. "No idea who he is." He stands, and finally I see his face. He wears dark sunglasses, and his mouth is bent into a snarl. His cheek is rippled with scars, like his hands. He leans close to my face. His breath smells like cigarettes. "Not real," I remind myself. "Not real." "You're lying," he says. "You're lying." "I am not. I can see it in your eyes." I pull myself up straighter. "You can't." "If you know him," he says in a low voice, "you could save me. You could save me." I narrow my eyes. "Well," I say. I set my jaw. "I don't." Chapter 3. I wake to sweaty palms and a pang of guilt in my chest. I am lying in the chair in the mirrored room. When I tilt my head back, I see Tori behind me. She pinches her lips together and removes electrodes from our heads. I wait for her to say something about the test, that it's over, or that I did well. Although how could I do poorly on a test like this? But she says nothing, just pulls the wires from my forehead. I sit forward and wipe my palms off on my slacks. I had to have done something wrong, even if it only happened in my mind. Is that strange look on Tori's face because she doesn't know how to tell me what a terrible person I am? I wish she would just come out with it. "That," she says, "was perplexing. Excuse me, I'll be right back." Perplexing? I bring my knees to my chest and bury my face in them. I wish I felt like crying, because the tears might bring me a sense of release. But I don't. How can you fail a test you aren't allowed to prepare for? As the moments pass, I get more nervous. I have to wipe off my hands every few seconds as the sweat collects. Or maybe I just do it because it helps me feel calmer. What if they tell me that I'm not cut out for any faction? I would have to live on the streets, with the factionless. I can't do that. To live factionless is not just to live in poverty and discomfort. It is to live divorced from society, separated from the most important thing in life. Community. My mother told me once that we can't survive alone, but even if we could, we wouldn't want to. Without a faction, we have no purpose, and no reason to live. I shake my head. I can't think like this. I have to stay calm. Finally, the door opens, and Tori walks back in. I grip the arms of the chair. "Sorry to worry you," Tori says. She stands by my feet with her hands in her pockets. She looks tense and pale. "Beatrice, your results were inconclusive," she says. "Typically, each stage of the simulation eliminates one or more of the factions, but in your case, only two have been ruled out." I stare at her. "Two?" I ask. My throat is so tight it's hard to talk. "If you had shown an automatic distaste for the knife and selected the cheese, the simulation would have led you to a different scenario that confirmed your aptitude for amity. That didn't happen, which is why amity is out." Tori scratches the back of her neck. "Normally, the simulation progresses in a linear fashion, isolating one faction by ruling out the rest. The choices you made didn't even allow candor, the next possibility, to be ruled out. So I had to alter the simulation to put you on the bus. And there your insistence upon dishonesty ruled out candor." She half smiles. "Don't worry about that. Only the candor tell the truth in that one. One of the knots in my chest loosens. Maybe I'm not an awful person. I suppose that's not entirely true. People who tell the truth are the candor, and the abnegation, she says, which gives us a problem. My mouth falls open. On the one hand, you threw yourself on the dog rather than let it attack the little girl, which is an abnegation-oriented response. But on the other, when the man told you that the truth would save him, you still refused to tell it. Not an abnegation-oriented response. She sighs. Not running from the dog suggests dauntless, but so does taking the knife, which you didn't do. She clears her throat and continues. Your intelligent response to the dog indicates strong alignment with the erudite. I have no idea what to make of your indecision in stage one, but... Wait, I interrupt her. So you have no idea what my aptitude is? Yes and no. My conclusion, she explains, is that you display equal aptitude for abnegation, dauntless, and erudite. People who get this kind of result are... She looks over her shoulder, like she expects someone to appear behind her. Are called divergent. She says the last word so quietly that I almost don't hear it. And her tense, worried look returns. She walks around the side of the chair and leans in close to me. Beatrice, she says, under no circumstances should you share that information with anyone. This is very important. We aren't supposed to share our results. I nod. I know that. No. Tori kneels next to the chair now and places her arms on the armrest. Our faces are inches apart. This is different. I don't mean you shouldn't share them now. I mean you should never share them with anyone, ever, no matter what happens. Divergence is extremely dangerous. You understand? I don't understand. How could inconclusive test results be dangerous? But I still nod. I don't want to share my test results with anyone anyway. Okay. I peel my hands from the arms of the chair and stand. I feel unsteady. I suggest, Tori says, that you go home. You have a lot of thinking to do. And waiting with the others may not benefit you. I have to tell my brother where I'm going. I'll let him know. I touch my forehead and stare at the floor as I walk out of the room. I can't bear to look her in the eye. I can't bear to think about the choosing ceremony tomorrow. It's my choice now, no matter what the test says. Abnegation, dauntless, erudite. Divergent. I decide not to take the bus. If I get home early, my father will notice when he checks the house log at the end of the day, and I'll have to explain what happened. Instead, I walk. I'll have to intercept Caleb before he mentions anything to our parents. But Caleb can keep a secret. I walk in the middle of the road. The buses tend to hug the curb, so it's safer here. Sometimes on the streets near my house, I can see places where the yellow lines used to be. We have no use for them now that there are so few cars. We don't need stoplights either, but in some places, they dangle precariously over the road like they might crash down any minute. Renovation moves slowly through the city, which is a patchwork of new clean buildings and old crumbling ones. Most of the new buildings are next to the marsh, which used to be a lake a long time ago. The Abnegation Volunteer Agency my mother works for is responsible for most of those renovations. When I look at the abnegation lifestyle as an outsider, I think it's beautiful. When I watch my family move in harmony, when we go to dinner parties and everyone cleans together afterward without having to be asked, when I see Caleb help strangers carry their groceries, I fall in love with this life all over again. It's only when I try to live it myself that I have trouble. It never feels genuine. But choosing a different faction, means I forsake my family permanently. Just past the abnegation sector of the city is the stretch of building skeletons and broken sidewalks that I now walk through. There are places where the road has completely collapsed, revealing sewer systems and empty subways that I have to be careful to avoid, and places that stink so powerfully of sewage and trash that I have to plug my nose. This is where the factionless live. Because they failed to complete initiation into whatever faction they chose, they live in poverty, doing the work no one else wants to do. They are janitors and construction workers and garbage collectors. They make fabric and operate trains and drive buses. In return for their work, they get food and clothing. But as my mother says, not enough of either. I see a factionless man standing on the corner up ahead. He wears ragged brown clothing, and skin sags from his jaw. He stares at me, and I stare back at him, unable to look away.
"Excuse me," he says.
His voice is raspy.
"Do you have something I can eat?"
I feel a lump in my throat. A stern voice in my head says, "Duck your head and keep walking." "No." I shake my head. I should not be afraid of this man. He needs help, and I'm supposed to help him.
Yes,
I say. I reach into my bag. My father tells me to keep food in my bag at all times for exactly this reason. I offer the man a small bag of dried apple slices. He reaches for them, but instead of taking the bag, his hand closes around my wrist. He smiles at me. He has a gap between his front teeth.
"My, don't you have pretty eyes?"
he says.
"It's a shame the rest of you is so plain."
My heart pounds. I tug my hand back, but his grip tightens. I smell something acrid and unpleasant on his breath.
"You look a little young to be walking around by yourself, dear,"
he says. I stop tugging and stand up straighter. I know I look young. I don't need to be reminded. "I'm older than I look," I retort. "I'm 16. His lips spread wide, revealing a gray molar with a dark pit in the side. I can't tell if he's smiling or grimacing.
"Then isn't today a special day for you? The day before you choose."
"Let go of me," I say. I hear ringing in my ears. My voice sounds clear and stern, not what I expected to hear. I feel like it doesn't belong to me. I am ready. I know what to do. I picture myself bringing my elbow back and hitting him. I see the bag of apples flying away from me. I hear my running footsteps. I am prepared to act. But then he releases my wrist, takes the apples and says,
"Choose wisely, little girl."
Chapter 4. I reach my street 5 minutes before I usually do, according to my watch, which is the only adornment abnegation allows, and only because it's practical. It has a gray band and a glass face. If I tilt it right, I can almost see my reflection over the hands. The houses on my street are all the same size and shape. They are made of gray cement, with few windows, in economical, no-nonsense rectangles. Their lawns are crabgrass, and their mailboxes are dull metal. To some, the sight might be gloomy, but to me, their simplicity is comforting. The reason for the simplicity isn't disdain for uniqueness, as the other factions have sometimes interpreted it. Everything, our houses, our clothes, our hairstyles, is meant to help us forget ourselves and to protect us from vanity, greed, and envy, which are just forms of selfishness. If we have little and want for little, we are all equal. We envy no one. I try to love it. I sit on the front step and wait for Caleb to arrive. It doesn't take long. After a minute, I see gray-robed forms walking down the street. I hear laughter. At school, we try not to draw attention to ourselves, but once we're home, the games and jokes start. My natural tendency toward sarcasm is still not appreciated. Sarcasm is always at someone's expense. Maybe it's better that abnegation wants me to suppress it. Maybe I don't have to leave my family. Maybe if I fight to make abnegation work, my act will turn into reality.
Beatrice, Caleb says. What happened? Are you all right?
I'm fine. He is with Susan and her brother Robert, and Susan is giving me a strange look, like I am a different person than the one she knew this morning. I shrug. When the test was over, I got sick. Must have been that liquid they gave us. I feel better now, though. I try to smile convincingly. I seem to have persuaded Susan and Robert, who no longer look concerned for my mental stability. But Caleb narrows his eyes at me, the way he does when he suspects someone of duplicity.
Did you two take the bus today? I ask. I don't care how Susan and Robert got home from school, but I need to change the subject.
Our father had to work late, Susan says, and he told us we should spend some time thinking before the ceremony tomorrow. My heart pounds at the mention of the ceremony.
You're welcome to come over later if you'd like, Caleb says politely.
Thank you. Susan smiles at Caleb. Robert raises an eyebrow at me. He and I have been exchanging looks for the past year, as Susan and Caleb flirt in the tentative way known only to the abnegation. Caleb's eyes follow Susan down the walk. I have to grab his arm to startle him from his daze. I lead him into the house and close the door behind us. He turns to me. His dark, straight eyebrows draw together, so that a crease appears between them. When he frowns, he looks more like my mother than my father. In an instant, I can see him living the same kind of life my father did. Staying in abnegation, learning a trade, marrying Susan, and having a family. It would be wonderful. I may not see it.
Are you going to tell me the truth now?
He asks softly.
The truth is, I say, I'm not supposed to discuss it, and you're not supposed to ask.
All those rules you bend, and you can't bend this one? Not even for something this important? His eyebrows tug together, and he bites the corner of his lip. Though his words are accusatory, it sounds like he is probing me for information, like he actually wants my answer. I narrow my eyes.
Will you? What happened in your test, Caleb?
Our eyes meet. I hear a train horn, so faint it could easily be wind whistling through an alleyway. But I know it when I hear it. It sounds like the Dauntless, calling me to them.
Just don't tell our parents what happened, okay? I say.
His eyes stay on mine for a few seconds, and then he nods. I want to go upstairs and lie down. The test, the walk, and my encounter with the factionless man exhausted me. But my brother made breakfast this morning, and my mother prepared our lunches, and my father made dinner last night, so it's my turn to cook. I breathe deeply and walk into the kitchen to start cooking. A minute later, Caleb joins me. I grit my teeth. He helps with everything.
What irritates me most about him is his natural goodness, his inborn selflessness.
Caleb and I work together without speaking. I cook peas on the stove. He defrosts 4 pieces of chicken. Most of what we eat is frozen or canned, because farms these days are far away. My mother told me once that, a long time ago, there were people who wouldn't buy genetically engineered produce because they viewed it as unnatural. Now we have no other option. By the time my parents get home, dinner is ready and the table is set. My father drops his bag at the door and kisses my head. Other people see him as an opinionated man. Too opinionated, maybe. But he's also loving. I try to see only the good in him. I try.
How did the test go?
He asks me. I pour the peas into a serving bowl. Fine, I say. I couldn't be candor. I lie too easily.
I heard there was some kind of upset with one of the tests, my mother says.
Like my father, she works for the government, but she manages city improvement projects. She recruited volunteers to administer the aptitude tests. Most of the time, though, she organizes workers to help the factionless with food and shelter and job opportunities.
Really?
Says my father. A problem with the aptitude tests is rare. I don't know much about it, but my friend Aaron told me that something went wrong with one of the tests, so the results had to be reported verbally. My mother places a napkin next to each plate on the table. Apparently, the student got sick and was sent home early. My mother shrugs. I hope they're all right. Did you two hear about that?
No,
Caleb says. He smiles at my mother.
My brother couldn't be candor either.
We sit at the table. We always pass food to the right, and no one eats until everyone is served. My father extends his hands to my mother and my brother, and they extend their hands to him and me. And my father gives thanks to God for food and work and friends and family. Not every abnegation family is religious, but my father says we should try not to see those differences because they will only divide us. I am not sure what to make of that. So, my mother says to my father, tell me. She takes my father's hand and moves her thumb in a small circle over his knuckles. I stare at their joined hands. My parents love each other, but they rarely show affection like this in front of us. They taught us that physical contact is powerful, so I have been wary of it since I was young. Tell me what's bothering you, she adds. I stare at my plate. My mother's acute senses sometimes surprise me, but now they chide me. Why was I so focused on myself that I didn't notice his deep frown and his sagging posture?
I had a difficult day at work, he says. Well, really, it was Marcus who had the difficult day. I shouldn't lay claim to it.
Marcus is my father's co-worker. They are both political leaders. The city is ruled by a council of 50 people, composed entirely of representatives from abnegation, because our faction is regarded as incorruptible, due to our commitment to selflessness. Our leaders are selected by their peers for their impeccable character, moral fortitude, and leadership skills. Representatives from each of the other factions can speak in the meeting on behalf of a particular issue, but ultimately, the decision is the council's. And while the council technically makes decisions together, Marcus is particularly influential. It has been this way since the beginning of the Great Peace, when the factions were formed. I think the system persists because we're afraid of what might happen if it didn't. War. Is this about the report Janine Matthews released? My mother says. Janine Matthews is Erudite's sole representative, selected based on her IQ score. My father complains about her often. I look up. A report? Caleb gives me a warning look. We aren't supposed to speak at the dinner table unless our parents ask us a direct question, and they usually don't. Our listening ears are a gift to them, my father says. They give us their listening ears after dinner, in the family room. Yes, my father says. His eyes narrow. Those arrogant, self-righteous... He stops and clears his throat. Sorry, but she released a report attacking Marcus's character. I raise my eyebrows. What did it say? I ask. Beatrice, Caleb says quietly. I duck my head, turning my fork over and over and over until the warmth leaves my cheeks. I don't like to be chastised, especially by my brother. It said, my father says, that Marcus's violence and cruelty toward his son is the reason his son chose Dauntless instead of abnegation. Few people who are born into abnegation choose to leave it. When they do, we remember. 2 years ago, Marcus's son Tobias left us for the Dauntless, and Marcus was devastated. Tobias was his only child, and his only family, since his wife died giving birth to their second child. The infant died minutes later. I never met Tobias. He rarely attended community events, and never joined his father at our house for dinner. My father often remarked that it was strange, but now it doesn't matter. Cruel? Marcus? My mother shakes her head. That poor man. As if he needs to be reminded of his loss.
Of his son's betrayal, you mean? My father says coldly. I shouldn't be surprised at this point. The erudite have been attacking us with these reports for months. And this isn't the end. There will be more. I guarantee it.
I shouldn't speak again, but I can't help myself. I blurt out, "Why are they doing this? Why don't you take this opportunity to listen to your father, Beatrice?" My mother says gently. It is phrased like a suggestion, not a command. I look across the table at Caleb, who has that look of disapproval in his eyes. I stare at my peas. I am not sure I can live this life of obligation any longer. I am not good enough.
You know why, my father says. Because we have something they want. Valuing knowledge above all else results in a lust for power, and that leads men into dark and empty places. We should be thankful that we know better.
I nod. I know I will not choose erudite, even though my test results suggested that I could. I am my father's daughter. My parents clean up after dinner. They don't even let Caleb help them, because we're supposed to keep to ourselves tonight, instead of gathering in the family room, so we can think about our results. My father might be able to help me choose, if I could talk about my results. But I can't. Tori's warning whispers in my memory, every time my resolve to keep my mouth shut falters. Caleb and I climb the stairs and, at the top, when we divide to go to our separate bedrooms, he stops me with a hand on my shoulder. Beatrice, he says, looking sternly into my eyes. We should think of our family. There is an edge to his voice. But we must also think of ourselves. For a moment I stare at him. I have never seen him think of himself. Never heard him insistent on anything but selflessness. I am so startled by his comment that I just say what I am supposed to say. The tests don't have to change our choices. He smiles a little. Don't they, though? He squeezes my shoulder and walks into his bedroom. I peer into his room and see an unmade bed and a stack of books on his desk. He closes the door. I wish I could tell him that we're going through the same thing. I wish I could speak to him like I want to, instead of like I'm supposed to. But the idea of admitting that I need help is too much to bear. So I turn away. I walk into my room, and when I close my door behind me, I realize that the decision might be simple. It will require a great act of selflessness to choose abnegation, or a great act of courage to choose dauntless. And maybe just choosing one over the other will prove that I belong. Tomorrow, those two qualities will struggle within me, and only one can win.
Chapter 5. The bus we take to get to the choosing ceremony is full of people in gray shirts and gray slacks. A pale ring of sunlight burns into the clouds like the end of a lit cigarette. I will never smoke one myself. They are closely tied to vanity. But a crowd of candor smokes them in front of the building when we get off the bus. I have to tilt my head back to see the top of the hub. And even then, part of it disappears into the clouds. It is the tallest building in the city. I can see the lights on the two prongs on its roof from my bedroom window. I follow my parents off the bus. Caleb seems calm, but so would I, if I knew what I was going to do. Instead, I get the distinct impression that my heart will burst out of my chest any minute now, and I grab his arm to steady myself as I walk up the front steps. The elevator is crowded, so my father volunteers to give a cluster of Amity our place. We climb the stairs instead, following him unquestioningly. We set an example for our fellow faction members, and soon the three of us are engulfed in the mass of gray fabric ascending cement stairs in the half-light. I settle into their pace, the uniform pounding of feet in my ears, and the homogeneity of the people around me makes me believe that I could choose this. I could be subsumed into abnegation's hive mind, projecting always outward. But then my legs get sore, and I struggle to breathe,
and I am again distracted by myself. We have to climb 20 flights of stairs to get to the choosing ceremony. My father holds the door open on the 20th floor and stands like a sentry as every abnegation walks past him. I would wait for him, but the crowd presses me forward, out of the stairwell and into the room where I will decide the rest of my life. The room is arranged in concentric circles. On the edges stand the 16-year-olds of every faction. We are not called members yet. Our decisions today will make us initiates, and we will become members if we complete initiation. We arrange ourselves in alphabetical order, according to the last names we may leave behind today. I stand between Caleb and Danielle Poehler, an Amity girl with rosy cheeks and a yellow dress. Rows of chairs for our families make up the next circle. They are arranged in 5 sections, according to faction. Not everyone in each faction comes to the choosing ceremony, but enough of them come that the crowd looks huge. The responsibility to conduct the ceremony rotates from faction to faction each year, and this year is abnegations. Marcus will give the opening address and read the names in reverse alphabetical order. Caleb will choose before me. In the last circle are 5 metal bowls so large they could hold my entire body if I curled up. Each one contains a substance that represents each faction. Gray stones for abnegation, water for erudite, earth for amity, lit coals for dauntless, and glass for candor. When Marcus calls my name, I will walk to the center of the 3 circles. I will not speak. He will offer me a knife. I will cut into my hand and sprinkle my blood into the bowl of the faction I choose. My blood on the stones. My blood sizzling on the coals. Before my parents sit down, they stand in front of Caleb and me. My father kisses my forehead and claps Caleb on the shoulder, grinning. "See you soon," he says, without a trace of doubt. My mother hugs me, and what little resolve I have left almost breaks. I clench my jaw and stare up at the ceiling, where globe lanterns hang and fill the room with blue light. She holds me for what feels like a long time, even after I let my hands fall. Before she pulls away, she turns her head and whispers in my ear, "I love you, no matter what." I frown at her back as she walks away. She knows what I might do. She must know, or she wouldn't feel the need to say that. Caleb grabs my hand, squeezing my palm so tightly it hurts, but I don't let go. The last time we held hands was at my uncle's funeral, as my father cried. We need each other's strength now, just as we did then. The room slowly comes to order. I should be observing the dauntless. I should be taking in as much information as I can, but I can only stare at the lanterns across the room. I try to lose myself in the blue glow. Marcus stands at the podium between the erudite and the dauntless and clears his throat into the microphone. "Welcome," he says. "Welcome to the choosing ceremony. Welcome to the day we honor the democratic philosophy of our ancestors, which tells us that every man has the right to choose his own way in this world. Or, it occurs to me, one of 5 predetermined ways." I squeeze Caleb's fingers as hard as he is squeezing mine. "Our dependents are now 16. They stand on the precipice of adulthood, and it is now up to them to decide what kind of people they will be." Marcus's voice is solemn, and gives equal weight to each word. "Decades ago, our ancestors realized that it is not political ideology, religious belief, race, or nationalism that is to blame for a warring world. Rather, they determined that it was the fault of human personality, of humankind's inclination toward evil, in whatever form that is. They divided into factions that sought to eradicate those qualities they believed responsible for the world's disarray." My eyes shift to the bowls in the center of the room. What do I believe? I do not know. I do not know. I do not know. "Those who blamed aggression formed Amity." The Amity exchange smiles. They are dressed comfortably in red or yellow. Every time I see them, they seem kind. loving, free. But joining them has never been an option for me.
Those who blamed ignorance became the erudite,